We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 15th day of March 2011. It's a bit of a cloudy, overcast day in Sydney today. And this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now. In the studio today we have Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Ian. And we have, for one of the last couple of times, we're going to be graced by the presence of Phil York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, Bill. Good morning, Ian. Hi, everyone. Yep, a couple of weeks to go.
And we have this morning we have a new old face. We have Ray Lenton in the studio with us, and Ray's going to be contributing in future weeks, we hope. So it's great to see Ray in the studio with us.
Thank you, and good morning, everybody.
So in today's show, we have a pre-recorded piece with Erin Pitsey. Erin was the founder of the Modern Women's Shelter Movement and international author. Last on this program in March 2007. And that was such an interesting interview. It's been replayed several times since. Well, we've got a new interview with Erin, which we'll be putting on shortly. And we'll also be speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Farrelly, opinion columnist with the Sydney Morning Herald. She's an author, and she's also an architect. And she writes social pieces for the Herald, which we'll be looking forward to talking to her about. Mainly with both guests, we'll be talking about the issue of feminism, which I guess is a follow-up from last week's show when we acknowledged that it was International Women's Day on the 8th of March. So
we celebrated International Women's Day.
We did, and there's a fair bit in the news at the moment, so I think, Ian, you've got something there for us?
No, I've got a couple here. These are a bit more light-hearted. In this morning's Telegraph, under the heading Teens Party Goes Viral, Nathan Klein has written, "It was supposed to be a small house party with a few friends to celebrate her sweet 16th birthday, but 15-year-old Chatswood girl Jess was forced to call off her birthday bash yesterday after the party's details, advertised for everybody to see on Facebook, went viral with almost 150,000 people accepting the invitation." So there you go, people. When you put up invitations for your party on Facebook, you've got to be careful. She ended up actually having to cancel the party. It was supposed to be just for her friends, you know, and people in her year 10 class. She told guests via the social networking site that they could all bring friends. Within 24 hours, the party had more than 20,000 people listed as attending. And, of course, poor old Jess had to call it off. So there you go. Don't do that. That's not a very clever way to organise a party. Another one here. This one's also a little bit amusing in a more cynical kind of a way. "I'm a dad," crims say. Twist in political baby saga. Peter Allen in Paris has written, "When one of France's most high-profile single mothers had her first baby, dozens of rich and powerful men were put forward as possible fathers, including President Nicolas Sarkozy himself. But two murderers now claim they fathered the daughter of 45-year-old Rachida Dati during a wild sex session in a locked prison room. The former justice minister, Ms. Dati, the first Arab woman to hold high office, gave birth to Zora in January 2009. The list of possible fathers also includes former Spanish prime minister Jose Maria Aznar, actress Selma Hayek's husband François-Henri Pinault, former French sports minister Bernard Laporte, businessman Henri Proglioli, and a TV host known as Arthur. So there you go. Mr. Sarkozy had a fling with Miss Darty before he married Carla Bruni in 2008. There have also been claims that Miss Doty used an anonymous sperm donor. And all she said on the subject is that her lover was a prominent figure who travels a great deal. Could have been me. Hey.
Could have been.
Could have been me. There you go.
Just a local announcement. I announced this last week, but I'm going to be bringing it to your attention again. On Thursday, the 31st of March, right here in Liverpool, there will be a meeting with Federal Minister Chris Hayes. He will be attending our Dads in Distress meeting here at 7 p.m. and he would like to see as many dads possible from the local area coming along. And topics of discussion around family law and around the Child Support Agency. So come along. If you like more information, you can hit the Dads in Distress website. Just Google Dads in Distress, or you can phone me on 0401 426 101. And it's important we get as many guys as possible. You know, when a federal minister gets an inquiry or a complaint, it actually counts for over 100 votes within his area or her area. So let's make this a positive night and an information-packed night where we can get our stories, which are very important, to across to Federal Minister Chris Hayes.
Yeah, look, that is a very important meeting, and come on, I'm sure there are a lot of guys out there who are suffering with under these regimes, the Child Support Agency, the Family Court. This is your opportunity to get off your backsides, get out there and do something. So we'd like to see as many as possible get to that meeting and raise your concerns. Now, I might just mention the 7pm project last week had a program in which there was a segment discussing the bias against men in family law. There were interviews with Professor Patrick Parkinson, a number of dads. So if you're interested in seeing this this program, it was very professionally put together. You can go to the Dads on the Air website, www.dadsontheair.net, and you'll see a link there to the YouTube program, which will take you direct to that program. Might just mention there's a Working with Men Affected by Violence training program coming up. There are some limited places left because it's going to be held next Monday, March 21st, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Forum Room 1, Hyde Park Inn, 271 Elizabeth Street in Sydney. The training program is for health, welfare and community workers, and it provides information and strategies for working with men who are affected by violence in their relationships and presents a model for this work. This is being put on by the Men's Health Consultant, and in particular Greg Milan, who does a lot of work in this area of men's health and well-being. That you might also be aware, he has a book called Men's Health and Wellbeing, an A to Z Guide. And for people who sign up for this program next Monday, this book will be provided, as well as refreshments and lunch. So that's something to look out for. Now, just following International Women's Day, which was last Tuesday, the 8th of March, there were some letters to the Sydney Morning Herald, and I thought one in particular from an Alan Barron of Grovedale seemed to sum it up pretty well. He said, "So now we've had International Women's Day, I believe society's fair dinkum about gender equality when we celebrate International Men's Day." Well, we do celebrate International Men's Day. We've had a number of programs last year around International Men's Day, but it obviously didn't penetrate to Alan Barron. But he says, "I'll believe in gender equality when proponents show equal zeal in addressing high levels of male suicide and homelessness, record levels of male unemployment, the underrepresentation of males at tertiary institutions, underperformance of boys in education, and blatant discrimination of male partners in the family court." So equal opportunity does not mean equal outcomes, nor should it ever mean that. So that's what Alan Barron thinks about International Women's Day and some of the things that are going on in our society at the moment.
Just well, that's a pretty relevant kind of an observation, I would say. Most of the programs we do tend to back all that up. All of his everything he listed there, where men are disadvantaged in the current age, do ring true. So that's a reasonable comment. But we don't want to take away from International Women's Day. Women are wonderful and they're worth celebrating. And if it wasn't for women, there'd be no dads. There'd be no anybody.
True.
Another story here from the family court. It's a strange one, where a 7-year-old girl was caught in the middle of her parents' acrimonious relationship breakdown, and she was forced to assume an almost adult, if not parental, role herself to try and ease the conflict between them. The difference here is, and I suppose this is becoming more common, is that the parents were in fact a lesbian couple, and one of the mothers was the biological mother of the elder of the two children. So the same-sex couple got into difficulties. They've now got this very acrimonious relationship, and unfortunately it's affecting the children. The family consultant reported to the Federal Magistrates Court that the girls were struggling to cope. Not only was the conflict stressful for the children, but the mothers seemed emotionally exhausted by their acrimonious relationship. Anyway, the final decision by Federal Magistrate Turner was to order that the children live with the elder girl's birth mother and spend regular time with the other mother, and the woman had to stop bickering and exposing their children to conflict. I sometimes find that the breakup of lesbian relationships are more destructive than even any other relationships. So also during the week we saw Gail Kelly on Q&A, and she was confronted by a member of the audience about the issue of pay equity. And there's this frequently quoted, I think it was also in the Advertiser article on March the 8th, 2011, quoting Penny Wong, who is the Minister for Finance in the Australian Labor government at the moment. And she quoted once again the erroneous figure that Australian women currently earn 83 cents for every dollar earned by men in an equivalent job. Even developed this by saying, translating this over the course of their working lives, each Australian woman will earn hundreds of thousands of dollars less than a male counterpart. Now, this was correctly challenged by Gail Kelly, the CEO of Westpac, who noted that it would be illegal for a woman doing the same job as a man to get less pay than the man was getting. And it was also picked up in comments on the story in some blogs here. Greg Andreessen of Sydney posted one which said that, yes, in the 1960s, women in the public service had to make a choice, family or career. Men in the 60s didn't have a choice. They had to have a career to work to, and so they could provide for their family. They didn't have the choice of deciding whether they could stay at home or go to work. And really, not much has changed in Australia today, with men by and large still deemed to be the breadwinner, while women have more choices about whether to work, raise children, or a combination of the two. There's no government paternity leave available, for example. It's only maternity leave, although it's called family leave. And commenting on the 83% figure, Ms. Wong has her facts wrong. What she should be saying is that men and women in equivalent jobs actually earn exactly the same amount. It is illegal to pay otherwise. What she meant to say, and it's hard to believe that the finance minister could be so ignorant about this, is that women on average earn 83% of what men earn on average. And this is largely due to the job choices that men and women freely make. Not many women choose to do dangerous but highly paid work, such as mining and construction. And not many men choose to do fulfilling but safe and lower paid work, such as childcare. And I know for a fact that in the oil industry, there was never an application by any woman to work on the oil rigs, which are very highly paid jobs.
And also, we had that nonsense last week proposed by Joe Hockey and others that they legislate for 30% of women to appear on boards of companies in Australia, which is patently nonsense, as these kind of situations do not suit women. And when women do get in these situations, they get paid just as well as men. I think it would be just as reasonable for Joe Hockey to try and legislate that 30% of men bear children.
Yeah, see, the quota argument has always got some flaws in it, and I think you'll find there are a lot of people out there who might agree with the principle of having more women on boards, and that's another question, but doing it by way of
legislation, it's nanny state nonsense. I mean, legislation, you can't legislate for things like that. You're not going to get desirable outcomes. It's just going to create more problems.
Just a couple of other items with programs coming up. There's a program called the Community Rites of Passage Becoming Men program. This is on from Wednesday the 18th to Saturday the 21st of May at Bruny Island, and this is going to allow fathers and their children to actually spend some time together. It's a 4 days. They develop a stronger relationship with their fathers, and with the young women, they're motivated to set goals and finish school and generally demonstrate improved social skills. So there's going to be an information session on actually tonight, but I'm sure you could get more information, registration forms, and find out a bit more about the course by contacting the program coordinator, Alan Raby. That's R-A-B-Y. You can go to him on his email address, which is A-L-A-N-R-A-B-Y, Alan Raby, at Westnet, W-E-S-T-N-E-T, .com.au, or you can call him on 03-6248-1690. So let's get some more information about that camp, which sounds like an excellent project. Now, finally, just in the... this is an article from The Sun in the UK. It's headed Dads in Despair. The Sun has been taking note of the plight of fathers forcibly estranged from their children by the family court system. Sounds familiar? This is actually in England. The Sun wants to start the ball rolling by highlighting the cases of just a handful of the thousands of men out there who want to be good dads but feel thwarted, desperate and voiceless. They promote out-of-court options, which again, until the family court changes its ways, has got to be the best way forward. And they're starting this campaign. It'd be nice to see something like that in Sydney or in Australia. And finally, the Men's in Sheds, the Australian Men's Sheds Association, is having its fourth national conference in 2011. This is going to be held in Brisbane. And it's for people who want more information, go to www.menshed.org. The early bird registration deadline is Monday the 11th of July, and the actual conference is going to be held from the 21st to the 23rd of August 2011. They do wonderful work, the Men's Shed, and we've had the founder of the Men's Sheds on this program in previous times, so keep an eye out for that one. And people who are interested, yes, go to the Men's Sheds website and you'll get all the information. So we might go to a short break and we'll be back with our first guest, Erin Pitsey.
Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. The storm clouds opened. Down came the rain. Everything I thought was precious went down the drain. Wasted promises, wasted lies, wasted kisses, wasted goodbyes. Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. Here today, gone tomorrow. The only thing that's left of value is sorrow. Wasted kisses, a big wasted mess. We were wasted, I confess. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. The story has ended. The plot has run out. The paper was wasted, just writing it down. Everything wasted, wasted for miles. Wasted lives, wasted smiles. Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you.
hours in wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit.
And we were wasted kisses,
wasted to blue.
My kisses were wasted on you.
And we were wasted
hours in wasted pursuit.
I was wasting my time picking
the wrong fruit.
Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit.
I was
wasting my time picking the wrong fruit.
Wasted kisses, wasted blue.
My kisses were wasted on you.
Wasted hours and wasted pursuit.
I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And good morning. Our guest today is Erin Pitsey. Erin Patria Margaret Pitsey. And Erin, this is a very historic day. Once again, we had an interview with you back in 2007. Erin is a world-renowned specialist on gender issues, a world-renowned commentator. She's written a number of books, including How Feminists Try to Destroy the Family. And when we last spoke to Erin, she had just been to Bahrain and opened a domestic violence refuge here. There, on this occasion, we've just recently had the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day, and we were hoping to talk to Erin about some of the issues surrounding feminism. Erin, good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have you back on the show. And
thank you.
Since 2007, we've actually replayed that interview several times. It was just great to hear your views on so many things. But I suppose, starting off, have you seen many changes between 2007 and where we are today?
I've seen some good changes. The most important changes are the general understanding now that domestic violence isn't something that men do to women. And this is the general public, certainly in the countries that I know, and certainly in America, because I'm in LA a lot because my son's there. So overall, the climate's changing to where I think we're getting a much more honest view of domestic violence. Unfortunately, of course, it hasn't touched the people who run the various countries, particularly the women feminists like we have here in England. We have Harriet Harman and various other women at the top who still absolutely insist it's all men. And now we have a very dangerous move, which I think is happening in other countries. It's called go orders. This is going to give the police absolute power when they're called into a house to remove whoever they feel like removing without any recourse to the law. So in essence, it takes away a person's right to legal representation. It's a very, very dangerous bill, and it's going through Parliament now.
Yes, grave concern. And we have something similar in various states in Australia because it's a state matter. Certainly in Victoria, they have those powers. The police can just come and arrest following a complaint. And New South Wales...
No evidence required or anything.
No, that's right, just a phone call. And in
very, very dangerous. I mean, it's dangerous in terms of not just domestic violence, but it's dangerous in terms of how these kind of laws can then extend everywhere.
Yes, and well, in New South Wales, we've got an election coming up in 2 weeks, and we're hoping that with a change of philosophy, that some of these laws might be toned down, if not removed. But Erin, now just speaking about your personal background, I mean, you were born in China, you were captured by the Japanese, you've lived in the Middle East, you've been in England, you've been in the United States. With all that excitement, what led you to go into being the founder of the modern women's shelter movement and all the feminist issues that you're now fighting for?
Well, the initial imperative was that I had having born and raised in the Middle East with big extended families all around me, came back to England. And I just remember when I was married and had two small children being incredibly lonely and isolated, because that's the 70s, we're talking about 1769 when I was in London, feeling that this is not the way that women were normally expected to bring up children. Well, we tended to bring up children in extended families. And I remember that was the beginning of the women's movement. It just erupted in 69. And I joined the women's movement believing that we could create a place for women to meet with their children and to use the talents that we had while we were at home with our children. And then listening to what was happening then with these huge collectives, and standing up and actually taking all these women on and saying, look, marriage is not a dangerous place for women and children. This is absolute nonsense. And I just remember all of us were organized into what's called collectives, and we were supposed to meet in our own homes and discuss our oppression by men. And I just remember thinking to myself, because I was quite an expert on communism by that time, because my parents in 1949 were sent back to China and were captured by the communists and put under house arrest for 3 years, and we didn't see them. And we didn't even know at one point whether they were alive or not. My sister and I were at boarding school in England. And I was standing up and pointing this out and just getting into dreadful trouble. And eventually I was banned from all the collectives and all the meetings and went off to open what I believed in, which is a little community center where women could meet with their children during the daytime and use all the talents that they had, because that's the frustration for so many women who are home with children, because they're cut off and socially isolated. And almost immediately, a woman walked in called Kathy, and she was just horribly bruised. And I took her home that night, and then virtually within a matter of a few months, women from all over England, because you have to remember there was never any concept of a woman being able to run away with her children and take refuge. And all of a sudden, here was this one and only place where you could come and you would be protected. And so that was the beginning of the whole of the refuge movement. This tiny little house at 2 Belmont Terrace in Chiswick had two rooms upstairs, two rooms downstairs, an outside lavatory, and at night, mums used to sit with their backs against the walls and their heads on their knees, and we'd have mattresses from the Salvation Army, and the kids would lie like little kippers in rows on these mattresses, covered in those knitted blankets that you can get from Salvation Armies, and that's how we lived.
Yes, and in those early days, were there ever any men that would come to the shelters?
No, actually, it was interesting. The first thing that happened, and I realised, you see, I came to this whole problem even-handed. Both my parents were violent and dysfunctional. My father was 6'4", very frightening and raging. He didn't hit us, but he screamed and he ranted and he yelled and he bullied. My mother was 4'9". She was very violent. She would actually, particularly to me, she hated me. She said when I was born that I was born to be hanged. And so as the women came in, I could see very clearly there were two separate problems. Women who were innocent victims of their partners' violence, yes, their partners were brutal and violent, they weren't, and they weren't violent to their children. But the women that I was particularly drawn to were women like my mother. They were violent themselves, and were violent to their children, and they'd had violent childhoods, and they'd grown up to be attracted and to create violent relationships. Those are the women that most needed the help. And yes, men did come to the refuge looking for their wives and children, and often you could identify that the man was the innocent victim and that she was lying.
Yes, it must sometimes
be. From the very beginning, I could see that this was not a gender issue, and I did a study, which I had only just recently, 40 years later, managed to get published. It's a comparative study of the first 100 women, and of the 100 women, 62 were as violent as the men they left. Mm. Now, that piece of information has been out in the open for 40 years, but no one would touch it.
No, and that's still the case. And I guess you talked about your mother's background. I guess some people might say, oh, that might explain why she turned out the way she did. But in fact, you were able to break free of that genetic upbringing.
Yeah, what really happened was that because they were away, they were in the Foreign Office, So they lived abroad a lot. We were in boarding schools and holiday home. And it was Miss Williams at the holiday home who became my mentor. I've had this huge belief that what helps children transcend their own violent backgrounds are other models in their lives. I remember looking at this enormously powerful woman. She was 6'7", believe it or not. She was huge. And she was a golf champion. She ran the home for these children. It was her private house. And she also drove ambulances during the war. And I just looked at this woman and thought, this is who I'd want to be. This is what I would like to be like. Mm. And that was my model, and it saved me.
Yes, it must be great to have that personal role model. And I wonder in your own family, because you have a twin sister, don't you?
Yes.
Did that make it even harder? Did your mother favour the other sister?
Yes. Inasmuch, there's a condition called narcissistic exhibitionism. It's a personality disorder. My mother was a classic narcissistic exhibition, always had to be the centre of attention, frightful tantrums if she felt ignored or disregarded. They're very dangerous, they're very charismatic, people get very attracted to them, but they only love themselves. It's a solipsistic self-love, if you like. But my sister resembled my mother, so my mother, what I call, cannibalised her. So she, in a sense, relived her life through my sister. And yes, it was very dangerous for my sister. In a sense, in the oddest way, I was probably safer as the onlooker. Because I just took one look at my mother and I knew that she was just thoroughly bad news. And she didn't manage to damage me. It was very, in many ways, very damaging for my sister. But, you know, we both pulled through. She became an occupational therapist and she lives in America. We're very, very close. We speak every night. Mm. And my brother, he was very badly damaged, particularly by my father, who was very cruel to him, emotionally very cruel to him. And he ended up living in what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. And he became a writer. He wrote The Wild Geese, which became a very big film. And he died very young, unfortunately.
Oh, well, and did you find, you know, that's... There are so many sad parts of your story, but also some good parts, which we'll get to. But your mother being the way she was, did you nevertheless feel an attraction to her, like you often hear?
I never bonded with her. I mean, that wasn't very difficult because what happened is she didn't want children. She eventually decided she'd have to have a son to please my father, and she had two twin girls, which horrified her. And I was the one who forced her to have a cesarean, apparently. I was lying the wrong way. And after 3 days' labour, she had to have a cesarean. And neither parent ever forgave me. She never forgave me because she had a scar on her precious body. And my father never forgave me because he kept saying, "You nearly killed your mother." Mm. When we were born, she packed up all her belongings and then took off to visit all her friends across China. So she wasn't around for the first 3 months of our lives. We were in a nursery with a nanny. Mm. And I never bonded to her. Actually, to be honest with you, I never liked her. Mm. And I know it sounds very odd, but most people can't be honest about the relationship. They can often be honest about dads, but not about mums. But it's fair enough. I have to be straight about this. She was nothing much to like about her, to be honest. I mean, when you are with a narcissistic exhibitionist, what you realise, it's a bit like those, you know, those baby monkeys that they used to put those little iron figures.
Yes, the cloth mothers.
That thought was their mother, and they kept rushing up to the baby, to the iron figure, and touching it.
Yes.
She was a bit like that, and I just learned that's a very dangerous and painful thing to do.
Well, I guess you're an inspiration with that sort of background that you've turned out to be, well, really based more on the humanity than the ideology in setting up these shelters. But the feminist movement, I think one of the problems now, and whereas many of us perhaps used to call ourselves feminists, it now seems to hate men, doesn't it, the way feminists...
I think you have to strip it down to what it really was. It never was a movement. That's all a massive lie. And men are equally guilty of not seeing through it, men who call themselves feminists. Fact is, it was jobs for girls. It started off with a massive battle, if you remember, in the early days of the civil rights movement in America. And people like Susan Brown Miller and all of them, Gloria Steinem, all of them, actually created this women's movement, and the idea from the very beginning was to change the goalposts, because the left was then fighting against capitalism. And so what the feminist movement, they got together and they thought, how do we make this women's movement? How do we tap into all this power? Well, what we'll do is we'll move the goalposts. It's not capitalism that's the enemy any longer. It's the patriarchy. It's men in general. Now, how do we fund this movement? And that was the problem. It started in this huge fireworks. I've got a book coming out in May called This Way to the Revolution, and the book is all about this issue. So how do we actually fund this new movement so that we can carve an empire out? Well, they couldn't in the beginning. In 1969, there was a huge amount of explosion. It was the most popular chic radical thing to do was to be a feminist. And what happened then is that it almost died on its feet, because after the first explosions of publicity, most women just drifted away because it was far too radical. Most women don't hate men. Most women do want to be married with children. Most women want equality, and men want equality for women. So it began to fade away, and I knew this was going to happen. As suddenly the refuge sprung into action, because there was this huge need, what happened was the funding was coming our way. The general population in England was sending money through the post to us. And I knew that it wouldn't be long before I'd hear the tramp of their bother boots. And sure enough, 1974, suddenly, after a lot of organizing that I wasn't even aware of, partly because I was inundated with mothers and children into these refuge that I had, there was a big conference in the National Federation of Women's Aid, heavily feminist, voted itself into being. And the government of Britain were only too grateful. What they didn't want is what I was doing, which was having this one huge house, ever open door, day and night, exposing the problem that everybody knew existed, but nobody was doing anything about, of what was happening to women and children and men behind the front door.
Yes.
Once that happened, once the feminists managed to get their hands on the on an open refuges, then it simply became a staging post for funding an ideological movement. Most of the money doesn't go to shelters or refuges. Most of the money goes into supplying the fees for the conferences and the various political activities that go on around this subject. So I think you have to forget feminism as a women's movement. It never was.
Yes,
feminism is basically a way of funding women across the world into a women's only empire. Yes. Like the refuges, for instance. No men can work in refuges. No men can sit on a board. Boys over 12, sometimes over 9, can't go into the refuges.
Mm.
I think it's very shocking that this can occur in this day and age.
Yes, and it is still occurring. I was seduced initially, I think, in 1969, when Germaine Greer came out to speak at Sydney University, and of course she's very
charismatic. Germaine Greer, of all people.
Yes, very charismatic.
Nothing
speaker.
Feminist, not Germaine Greer.
Yes, and she was very charismatic, and you know, that sort of got the movement. Well, you know, if it's not a movement, it got something moving anyway, and. There were a lot of men, I think, on site as well. But the men now, I suspect, have been sitting on their hands and allowed this thing to get out of hand.
Well, this has been the problem all along, and this is something I do get very upset with men. There is something about men that will not take care of each other over emotional issues.
Yes.
You know, it's extraordinary. I, almost immediately after I opened the refuge, I was aware of the need for men coming and saying, yes, but this is very well, but I'm living with a very violent woman and I've got children and I can't leave them with her. Exactly the same problem. So I got what was then the GLC to give me a big house in North London to open as a refuge for men. Now, the same men who were millionaires, who were willing to help me open refuge and keep the refuge door open for mothers and children, they wouldn't give me a penny for my men's house. I couldn't raise any money at all from anybody. And eventually it had to close.
Quite extraordinary.
That shocked me.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, we have the same problem in Australia. It's the government funds so many women's bodies who, with millions and millions of dollars, anything to do with men, you really struggle for anything. There are a few with very small funding. Dads in Distress gets a small funding. But when they have an inquiry, of course, they go to all their funded groups and they hear back what they want to hear. So it's an ongoing problem, and I suppose it just makes me wonder. You know, you're talking about those days in the late 60s, and here we are in 2011. Has much improved, do you think?
No, I don't think that side of it's much improved, and I don't think it will much improve until men actually decide that they've had enough and are going to make a change. But you see, I don't know that that'll ever happen. It's extraordinary how many men will come in when they have problems, and then you don't hear from them again once the problem's resolved. Whereas women are much more naturally inclined to stay and help each other. There just isn't. There's something about talking to men who feel incredibly uncomfortable if a man is having an emotional problem. It's almost like they fear his weakness, as they see it, is catching. If that makes any kind of sense.
Maybe that's the explanation. I've been searching for it myself because it's hard
to understand. I've been thinking about it very deeply because it really worries me.
Mm. Now,
daily, I see terrible, terrible cases, and I'm sure you do, where the courts and all the authorities are so feminized that men and men and fathers and boys are just brutalized.
Yes.
And we have such a climate in this country. I mean, I dread the results. I don't know if you have the same thing. When we have results for A-levels and the GCE levels from school and schools, the crowing about how girls are so much cleverer and what they achieve and how boys are useless in the press is actually horrific.
Yes, and we have the same problem. And I've noticed that with so many of these issues, that it seems to be a worldwide phenomenon. It's not just Australia or England.
Western phenomenon.
Yes, I think that's what it is. I noticed that your book, Prone to Violence, was boycotted by radical feminists, and it became...
It was heavily picketed. I had to have a police escort for that book. All around England, there were death threats out. That was before Salman Rushdie.
The
next one comes out on May the 14th, so I'm not expecting quite as violent a reaction. I mean, the book itself is probably more explicit than that book, which I wrote in 1982. But because, in a sense, the feminist movement, it's the refuge movement, the shelter movement, as they call it in America, is now very, very, it's a billion-dollar industry, and no one's going to actually upset the boat any longer. But it's still, until such time as we're willing to just take a very good look at what is actually a white elephant and demand that changes are made and that the lies are stopped, I don't think there's going to be much change.
Yes, well, you've got your new book coming out, and let's hope you don't get a fatwa or anything similar when that comes out. But I know it was boycotted by feminists, and it's very hard now to get a copy of it. How did they stop it getting out? Was pressure put on the publishers, or
what? Well, what happened is the original editor for the book, and I didn't know this because nobody told me, and she certainly didn't tell me. She was a very heavy feminist, which I didn't know. And what she didn't tell me is that the publisher, her publisher, they were going bankrupt. So it was a smart move to buy the book and then to know that it, within a matter of weeks of it being on the shelf, everything would have been taken down. But there was a very planned movement against the book. An awful lot of feminists in England went into shops and simply stole the books, took them off the shelves.
Oh, good heavens. So now you've got your new book, This Way to the Revolution, an autobiography, and I believe it's coming out in about May, is that correct?
May the 14th, yeah.
May the 14th. It just reminded me of a T-Rex song, We Won't Fool the Children of the Revolution, but I hope that's the case, that the children, as they're coming through, the next generation perhaps is going to see what's going on and want to.
Well, I think the tragedy of all this is the women who most need the feminist movement, if the feminist movement was a genuine movement for women, of the women who are violent themselves. Because what was happening when I opened the refuge was that all women who were on the run from violent relationships had only one offer from social services. We can't help you, but we can take your children into care, and then you have to look after yourself. So if women ran away, they knew that the result was they'd have to give up their children, which is why most of them didn't leave. Now, different situation. Where women make violent relationships, social services step in and say, we're going to take your children because we think that your children are in danger from the choices that you make. The point of the refuges should always have been that people who are innocent victims of their partners certainly need help, but the people who most need help are the women who are violent and violent to their children. And what Tizik was a huge therapeutic community to rehabilitate women who had never, as children, and grown up in from very violent and abusive and sexually abusive backgrounds, had never had any other alternative offered to them or help. Now, what the refuges did is they banned those women. They don't take women who are alcoholics or drug addicts or women who are violent. So the result is women who most need refuges can't get in, and there isn't treatment, because if you have a blanket ideology that says all women are innocent victims of men's violence, then the women who most need the help won't get it, won't be recognised.
Yeah, so there is the opportunity there to actually provide some therapy, some treatment, rather than just being a place to
absolutely.
Go.
Absolutely. And Chiswick itself, it was a massive big central crisis refuge. And then it had second stage housing. And these are housing where the women were very vulnerable and needed help and support. They moved into groups of 5 children, up to 15 kids, in these big comfortable houses. And they shared for a matter of years until their housing came up. Because the most... It's really quite cruel to take somebody who's... If you get into a very violent relationship, I think it's a bit like having almost terminal car crash, and you go into intensive care. Well, the equivalent is true of the emotional backfall of a very violent relationship. And what happens is you're usually dumped in a room on your own with your children, who are already disturbed by what's happened to them, and left to get on with it. And, of course, it just doesn't work.
Well, I think you've commented that what's wrong with a lot of these campaigns. I mean, there's the White Ribbon campaign, which is promoted heavily in Australia, and there's Say No to Violence Against Women. And I think you've said that these are unlikely to succeed because they're actually based on a lie. They're focusing
just
on...
Yes, and I think the whole... Until such time as the feminist movement are forced to accept that it's not a gender issue. And the tragedy of this is it's extraordinary ideology, because all figures prove that as far as domestic violence is concerned, intimate partner violence, the figures are equal. And that makes perfectly good sense, because if violence, as I say, is a learned pattern of behaviour from early childhood, then obviously both boys and girls are affected. Anecdotally, I can say that in the refuge, one thing I noticed is how much more affected the boys were by the violence than the girls. Girls are an awful lot more resilient. They tend to show up, and their violence and damage tends to show up very differently, because they're not so explosive. But all children are damaged by this. And in fact, if you read, I don't know if you know Dr. Bruce Perry.
No.
He has a big child development outfit in Houston. He writes the most brilliant papers, and he was doing studies on fetus in the womb and proving that children, babies who are marinated in violence, as he says, are born wired up to be damaged and disturbed. And we really do need to listen to this. Because, you know, when you hold your child, that's your genetic package.
Yes.
And thereafter, because the brain of a baby is plastic, it's experience that is the architect of the brain and the baby's personality. So it makes sense to understand that babies born into violent relationships, in fact, become brain damaged very quickly.
Yes, well, we often hear about the effect, or that children can hear voices before they're born, and I'm sure there is that influence, and they're probably very receptive to all that. So,
Well, if you smoke a cigarette, you share it with a baby, a drink, alcohol, you share, and the rages and the fear, the chemicals of fear and rage are also shared with the baby.
Yes. So, look, it's becoming very urgent, and perhaps one way of promoting the right message is I believe they're making a film about your life.
Yes, there's a very serious... There's a lovely actress called Kate Beckinsale, and she contacted me a couple of years ago, and she was very... has always been very keen, because she lived in Chiswick, and she used to walk past it as a child, and it's now very, very serious. We have a writer called Emma Forrest, and she's been in London pitching, and there's a brilliant film agent called Jenny Casarotto, and yes, it is moving, and hopefully... I don't care whether it's a film about my life or not, but a film about the big lie. How can a 40-year lie like this grow unimpeded? But how can it happen? It's frightening, isn't it?
Yes, you do wonder. But, you know, I think, I don't know whether you want to draw comparisons with Nazis, but they always said if you want to tell a lie, make it a big lie. So maybe.
Well, Goebbels said that, didn't he?
Yes, I think so. So maybe that's the answer. But I take it Angelina Jolie was not available to play your part, was she, Erin? I don't believe that for a moment, but well, that's so we've got your book to look forward to in May. That's called This Way to the Revolution, an autobiography. Mm-hmm. Then sometime after that, hopefully we'll see you at the movies, and you're always very welcome on this program. It's a wonderful pleasure to talk to you, Erin, and we've been speaking with Erin Pitsey, founder of the Modern Women's Shelter Movement and the international author with a great number of books. If people investigate put your name in Google, they'll see this massive volume of work, both fiction and non-fiction. So, Erin, could I, on behalf of Dads on the Air, thank you very much for coming on the program today.
I'm going to suggest, could you tell people to look at my website, erinpitsey.com. It's all on there.
Absolutely. So it's Erin, is it just the whole word, Erin Pitsey?
Yeah, erinpitsey.com.
Okay, and that's spelled P-I-Z-Z-E-Y.
Yeah.
So if people go to that website, they'll get the whole story and information on the books and information on the film and Erin's extraordinary life to date. So, Erin, once again, thank you for coming on the show, and we wish you all the best in your future work.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Erin. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, and our next guest is Dr. Elizabeth Farrelly, who is a Sydney-based columnist and author who trained in architecture and philosophy. She's practiced in London and Bristol and holds a PhD in architecture from the University of Sydney, where she is also adjunct associate professor. Elizabeth has written several books. She holds a number of national and international writing awards, and Elizabeth has just returned from overseas. Elizabeth, welcome to welcome back to Australia, and welcome to Dads on the Air.
Good morning. Thanks, Bill.
So, Elizabeth, I was particularly interested in your recent column. It was titled A Challenge for Feminism to Find an Honourable Role for Men. And we're 1 week out from International Women's Day. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your thoughts on feminism.
Well, look, it's a really interesting issue. And I'm surprised that I'm still interested in it, having grown up as a feminist. You know, and I figured when I was young that it was just obvious that equality should be the name of the game, but of course it's not as simple as you think. And I'm interested now at what seems to me to be some of the unintended consequences, I suppose, of feminism, and what I think of really as feminization, which isn't necessarily the same thing. Feminization of the workplace and of various other aspects of life, which I think has had some good effects and some perhaps less good effects.
So do you think feminism turned off the path from that they originally started off in, perhaps back in the days of Germaine Greer?
I'm not sure that it's ever really been coherent. And I mean, what I think really it's you'd have to regard it as a sort of an experiment, you know, something that's never really been done before, finding a way of providing dignity for both, if you like, parts of the relationship, both genders in a relationship. If you think of standard nuclear family or standard heterosexual relationship, which of course not all relationships are, but most still are, and that balance thing I think has never really been found in a way that's satisfactory for everyone. So I think it's not surprising that it hasn't achieved its aims. It's more that we have to go on hunting for ways of finding the kind of society we want.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps part of this, and I think you focused on this in your article, is what women want changing, do you think?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I think that one of the interesting things is that we do focus now so much on what women want, rather than, 50 years ago it would have been much more about what women were obliged to do, or what women's duty was, or what women needed to do. But now it's all about want, not just women, of course. Men, too, have all kinds of desires, and democracy brings those into the forefront of all of our lives and makes them the issue for the planet as much as for society. But I'm interested in the effects, I suppose, on men and boys. At least that particular article focused on some of those perhaps unintended consequences in terms of the role of men and the role of boys and the upbringing and shaping and moulding of boy characters within schools and families.
Yes, perhaps in days gone by, women were blamed in domestic situations for perhaps if the dad went off the rails, it somehow seemed to be converted into being the woman's fault, which is...
Absolutely. Yeah, well, women were blamed for everything. women were blamed if the children went, bad, if the father... Yeah, and women, I think it's not surprising that feminism came on board because women basically had enough. And the minute you say human beings are born equal, you have to, and then of course you give women the franchise, and you're pretty much committed to that path. And I think it's just gradually unfolding in front of us. But one of the things that disturbs me is that with feminism has tended, because of this focus on what women want, has tended to become sort of selfish, I suppose. It's tended to, in some cases, justify behaviours which, at least previously, would have been regarded as selfish and now regarded as a kind of self-affirmation. And to some extent, that's a good thing. But I think what we tend, as primates, I suppose, to lose sight of the big picture and to think that what we want, that our own driving desires, are the crucial thing, which I think they're not, or shouldn't be. Mm. And if they become our main drivers, then we're really in trouble, and so is the planet.
Yes, maybe the women aren't. It's a very worthwhile cause to try and work out what it is they do want, perhaps. But when you mentioned self-affirmation, you were commented in your article about a trend of perhaps women feminising men to make them perhaps more like themselves. And
that's really interesting, isn't it?
Yes, and perhaps we're going to meet in the middle somewhere.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, everywhere you look, and I was struck by an image actually when I was in London on the tube. There was this big image of Justin Bieber, you know, and when I first saw him, and of course they're everywhere, he looks like a girl, and there's the biggest heartthrob, and you think, what is that about? Is that some sort of, you know, is he a new Barbie doll that girls love in the way that they love girl dolls, which they always love girl dolls more than they love boy dolls. So there's an interesting kind of self-reflection thing happening there, and I'm very curious about whether that is becoming one of the effects of schools that are dominated by women teachers, and which expect sort of, if you like, girl behaviour from boys, in the sense that boys are expected to be very law-abiding and, you know, not naughty and not cheeky and not any of the things that we tend to regard as boy behaviours traditionally. Also, the remedies for those behaviours tend to be girl remedies, in the sense that they're, you know, we're not allowed to sort of smack bottoms or anything anymore, or give any kind of physical or even sort of shaming type punishment. So it's all about talk. It becomes a big talk fest, which is a very girl kind of thing to do. And so I was speculating that this kind of upbringing influence was actually starting to change boys into girls, and I don't know whether it's because that's what women actually want or whether it's a sort of an unforeseen consequence.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the idea put forward by Rich Zubati that that men are being encouraged to act out of their feminine side, which is their weak side, and women are being encouraged to act out of their masculine side, which is their weak side, and thereby men and women are both acting out of weakness, as opposed to in the good old days when women acted out of, from their feminine side, which was their strength, and men acted from the masculine side, which was their strength. What do you think of that?
I think that's very interesting, and it may be true. I don't know whether you would necessarily say, it's very difficult. As soon as you start saying men and women, then, you know, you're accused of essentialism, and I'm often accused of that. I do think there are essential differences, but I also think that there are huge varieties within, you know, there's a vast spectrum within women or men, and there are women who are naturally more masculine and men who are naturally more feminine, and that's fine. As far as I'm concerned, that's all fine. The natural spectrum of behaviours is fine, and our tolerance of that, and our increasing tolerance of that, is also good. But what disturbs me is the sort of push, if you like, to feminise all men, and perhaps to masculinise all women, although I find myself more comfortable with that idea. You know, if I look back at the suffragettes and the sort of horror of, you know, women smoking and women wearing trousers and women speaking out in public, and I think, well, of course women would do that, and that, I don't know whether I'm more comfortable with all that just because it's been around for longer, or whether there's something genuinely more acceptable, or I'm just plain prejudiced. It's hard to tell. but I find, I was just curious, really. I was trying, I suppose, not to cast judgments. I mean, if it is what we want, for men to become more feminine, and it may be that. It may be that that's all part of an overall civilizing process. It might be part of a genuine overall progress where we are becoming more like each other by way of becoming a better society, a more tolerant, less aggressive, if you like, on the part of males, and less emotional, perhaps, on the part of females. And we're all going to become more civilized and more like, maybe, I imagine, Scandinavian countries are, where everyone's a bit more grown up than we are. I don't know. That is a possible interpretation. So it could be a good thing. But I'm just intrigued by what it means, for example, for families, or indeed for sex. You know, if the poles of heterosexuality are becoming closer together, is there still going to be that strong attraction, or are we heading towards some more gender-neutral, much less passionate society? I don't know. And if that is so, is that a good thing? Mm. Which I'm also not sure about. I was really asking those questions and trying to unpick it.
Yes, it's... Well, it is interesting, and you clearly... I don't think anyone has the answers just yet. It's something we're going to have to watch as we go through. But there are some... I think there is some collateral damage going on at the moment. I mean, in other articles, you've talked about the... ADHD and the rise of the use of Ritalin, particularly with boys, and that maybe that's all part of it.
That's right. I find that quite disturbing, the medicalisation thing of behaviours generally, but in that particular case it does seem that that is in the service, if you like, of a kind of overarching feminisation of boys, which I think is a bit disturbing. I'm suspicious, of course, of medicalisation anyway, of treat, especially when we're... Because it tends to enforce a kind of sameness, I suppose. But I have had a number of letters, of course, from people, as I expected after that article, saying, oh, you know, my son was diagnosed ADHD, and you've got no idea how much better he was with that drug. So I've got no doubt that it's really, really good for people. But I think there are cases where it's a problem. Hello?
Yes, I'm still there.
Yeah, sorry, the phone's just beeping at me for some reason.
Yes. With feminism, would you class yourself as a feminist, and what do you think feminism means today?
Yeah, well, I would class myself as a feminist, absolutely. I've always thought that that feminism was just an obvious thing that everyone should agree with. But I'm not sure that I mean by it quite the same thing that other people mean by it. For example, people tend to bag feminism together with a whole lot of other social values, which some of which I probably support, like environmentalism in general, but some of which I might not. But I do think that feminism, as I wrote in that piece, needs to find a way forward for an honourable role for maleness in the world. It isn't just feminism. Of course, we all need that, and I think that we relinquish masculinity at our peril as a species. I think there are obvious ways in which historically masculinity has been essential to our progress, and as Camille Paglia once said, you know, if it was down to women, we'd still be living in grass huts. I think that's true. So I don't believe that it's important for us to, at least I don't think that we should relinquish masculinity at all as a set of values. And what I was trying to suggest in that piece was that it's important for us to try and find a kind of heroic model, or refine a heroic model of masculinity that suits the postmodern world in a way that we've come close to finding a heroic role for women. We need to find a similar one for men. And how we do that is a very interesting question.
Yes, well, with women, I think you've pointed out women can now go into lots of roles that they haven't in the past. But there are still always going to be some roles. I mean, I know from personal experience that women are not interested, for instance, in working on oil rigs and the more risky, dangerous type, but highly paid roles.
Yeah.
But they're not really interested in going there, are they?
Well, look, I don't know. I certainly wouldn't be myself. And I certainly wouldn't be interested in fighting in a war on the front line, for example, any of that stuff. I know that there, that you know, we're told that there are women who want to, and if they do want to, good luck to them. Yeah. I would say, I don't think there should be any legal impediments. Whether you can prevent there being any social impediments, those things, I don't know. I think, but if you're brave enough to do the work, I guess you're brave enough to put up with the sort of social issues. Obviously, the sort of sexual harassment stuff that happens in those situations is bad, and it's probably, I don't know what you do about that, you know, because it's kind of an occupational hazard, I would think, but I'm not suggesting for a minute that women should have to put up with it, because they shouldn't.
No.
But I believe that there are essential differences between men and women, and a lot of it's to do with having babies, you know, but you struggle with it. I think as a feminist, you always are going to struggle with the issues of being torn between the children that you're you know, that are your primary creative project. And the other thing, which for me and for a lot of women is also essential, that your working life is also really important, and it's really hard, genuinely hard, to find a way that balances those in without jeopardizing either of them. But I think one of the mistakes that feminism tends to make is to blame men for that difficulty. I don't think it's men's fault, or even the system's fault, and I can't see a way that the system could be changed. I mean, if it is a system thing, it's a sort of system called nature, you know, that we're up against. And there are things, in the end, that you just have to put up with. So one of the challenges is to find out which things you can change and which things you actually can't change, or if you do change them, you end up regretting it, like the sort of loss of masculinity, I suppose.
You did. I noticed before you used the word balance,
yeah.
which is instead of the word equality, because if you look at the word equality, really equality, there's no such thing. It's a mathematical fiction. It exists on blackboards,
yeah.
And the idea that a man equals a woman or a woman equals a man is inherently preposterous. Really, what seems to me what you're saying is that really what we are looking for in society is more balance, that this concept of equality is a nonsense and that we really should be getting away from it. Is that...
Well, I think there's a difference between equality as in status or in achievement or in role, and equality of opportunity. I mean, I do believe that we should try our very best to make opportunities available to everyone equally, so that, you know, you are not inhibited, not artificially inhibited because you're a woman or because you're, you know, gay or because you're any of the various other varieties of human. So I think that equality of opportunity is important for us to really treasure and to work towards, which we haven't achieved fully yet. But to what extent we can achieve that, I don't know. See, I've just been writing another thing about childcare, the childcare issue with, and its relationship with feminism, which got me to trouble when I was in London because I was talking about women and architecture and then again something else, and the childcare thing kept coming up and people are very angry about it. But, you know, the question in the end about the children thing is, would you actually give your children to someone else to look after in order to further your career? And of course, most of us do to some extent. We use childcare as it's available, but can you really argue that you should be able to leave work at 5 o'clock to pick up your kids from childcare and still be promoted along with the boys or the other people who are staying and working till 7 o'clock, say? And is there a way of making that fair? And I can't see how you can do it in any sensible way. You can't require people to pay people who leave early just as much as they're going to pay everyone else, or you can't require them to promote people like that who are, let's say, underachieving, just because they've got other interests, which are their children. So you can say, sure, men should be doing the picking up from aftercare or whatever it is, as much as women should. But maybe that'll happen. Maybe that will happen, and maybe that's fine. But most women do not really, in their heart of hearts, want to give away the intimate care of their children. So I think that's really a real difficulty.
Yes, well, I think there are two sides to that particular coin. With a woman in the workplace, it's quite often acceptable if her child is sick to have a day off work or to leave early, whereas that same liberty is not offered to men. And I think they would not be so regularly excused for something similar.
Well, that's right, although that's changing. I mean, my immediate boss has just taken 3 months or something off for paternity leave, so and those things are beginning to happen. And I'm told that in, you know, places like the Netherlands and Scandinavia, there's much greater equality in terms of state-assisted childcare and expectations of men being involved in those sorts of childcare things. But I suppose one of the questions then is, are men going to be prepared to accept diminished ambition or
yes,
career achievement because of that? And to what extent is that, and how then will they be comfortable with striking that balance? And I can't answer that question.
No.
It probably varies a lot from couple to couple and from person to person. And of course these things are also affected very much by divorce and the emotions that gather around all that stuff, and the parents' sense of rights, you know, over their children and blah, 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 all that stuff, which becomes very emotional very quickly. But and I don't know how that will pan out, but my feeling is that women will always be extremely attached to their children, because it's a big investment, you know, that you make in giving birth. So, yeah, whether that stuff will ever become equal and whether it should be genuinely equal, I don't know.
Yes, I'm obviously the father makes a big investment too, so it's...
Yeah,
that's,
it's true, although it's not quite the same as carrying a child in your body.
That's true, that's true.
Which is pretty serious business.
Yeah. But I guess what's concerning, and a lot of I've noticed when they recently named, I think, four women, including Jermaine Greer and Ms. Cox and a few others, as being the four great
on the
feminists.
Fence.
Yes.
Mm.
But at the I read at the launch that no one wanted to be called a feminist. And I just wonder if this is because it's now got these bad associations of hatred of males.
Isn't it? There is a sort of found myself calling in my mind a group of hairy-legged Guardian readers who, you know, which is a sort of radical feminist fringe, who are extremely aggressive and have perhaps given feminism a bad name. I think there's a bit of debate about this stuff amongst younger women about whether or not they are or aren't prepared to be called feminists. I mean, I don't care what you call it, frankly. I think the ideas are important. The word, you know, doesn't matter if we find another word for it, but it does matter that there is a word for it that is something that, you know, tries to signify that sense of not just sort of openness and equal opportunity and tolerance, but also a sense of forwardness, of needing to find a way forward into a change, the sort of into societal change, which is going to be acceptable. And I suspect that what we will, all of us, male and female, need to do is sacrifice some of that commitment to what we personally want for some more overarching sense of what is actually required of us. You know, like perhaps a rediscovery of a sense of duty is what I'm saying.
Yes, it's we need to find a way to open up the opportunities to so that we're getting the most out of the population, which is, you know, a bit over 50% female. And at the same time, I think we need to, if you look at the university admission rates, the university degrees, they're now getting to the stage where women are having the majority. And I think perhaps that's at the expense of boys and men. So somehow we need to find out a way of getting back to that balance you talked about, where
yeah.
Men aren't discriminated.
That's very interesting. The university thing, the numbers are on the female side, but then if you look at the power balance in, you know, professional and corporate life, it's still hugely on the male side. And so, you know, that begs the question as to whether that is actually changing or whether that's reached a kind of an impasse, and women argued that they, you know, the glass ceiling thing, that they sit there in middle management. And then if that is true, then is that something that women actually want to change? And some women say, yes, they do. It's just that the system's against them. And others will say, actually, when we're given the choice, we're going to choose looking after our kids more than we want that promotion. So I don't know.
But if you look at the political side of it, I mean, living in Sydney, Lord Mayor is Clover Moore as a woman. You know, Christina Keneally is our Premier. The Governor General of Governor is a woman. We've got Julia Gillard, and
we've got
the Queen, and also so at every level of power, now we have women.
That's right.
So you were saying, yeah, that is interesting. So
you need to note that both Julia and Christina, who are the two elected ones amongst all of them, sort of happened on it. They have not been popularly elected in that role, so they've kind of acquired the chalice.
And they're firsts.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens at the next election, I suppose, whether Clover is actually our first elected, as far as I know, female leader. And I think she's a jolly good Lord Mayor, I should say. But the others are a slightly different category.
Yes, look, we're running out of time, Elizabeth. It's a fascinating topic. I just noticed in one of the other articles you talked about guilt and about, I think you called it contested time, in which people try to get this balance. And I must admit, I had a friend who was did higher qualifications in law, in environmental law, and she felt guilty no matter what she did.
Yes.
If she stayed with the children, she felt she wasn't using a degree, and if she worked, she ignored her children. So
I think that's very, very common, and I think it is probably particularly female. I don't know whether it's possible that it's hormonal. I don't know, but I do know that feeling, and it just seems to characterize professional women's lives 100% of the time these days, which is very interesting, and maybe it's just the way things are. You sort of learn to live with it after a while, you know. But, and there's no, so that means that there's no possibility of feeling that you're doing it right. But you women are very self-critical, so maybe it's just part of that. I don't know.
Yes. Well, it's very uplifting talking to you, Elizabeth. We are speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Fraley, who's an opinion columnist with the Sydney Morning Herald, and I think we've got a lot of positive views there on feminism and what we can hope might come in the future. So, Maya, thank you very much on behalf of Dads on the Air.
Thank you.
And it's wonderful talking to you, and we wish you all the best.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for that.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Bye.
What women want is the fact they don't know what it is, and everyone else has to feel uneasy about it. What women want is the fact they don't know what it is, everyone else has to feel uneasy about it. Then we'll see a lady
walk in the wood
who asked me my name,
walk in the wood
before I could tell her,
walk in the wood
she just turned away. What women want is the fact they don't know what it is, everyone else has to feel uneasy about it. There was an old lady
walking the wood,
sitting alone
walking the wood,
wishing she married
walking the wood,
keep a job at home. What women want is the fact they don't know what it is, everyone else has to feel uneasy about it. What women want is the fact they don't know what it is, and everyone else has to feel uneasy about it. What women want is the fact they don't know what it is, everyone else has to feel uneasy about it.
Dads in Distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 15th day of March 2011, and this is for the last time today. We'll be back next week with another big show, but from today's show we'd like to especially thank our guests, Erin Pitsey, who we spoke to in London, and Dr. Elizabeth Fraley, who's just back from London, but in Sydney. Welcome back to Sydney, and it's been interesting to speak to them about developments in feminism, particularly following on from our show last week on International Women's Day. So if people would like to hear those interviews again or go to any of the archive programs, go to our website, www.dadsontheair.net, and I can hear the music in the background. So
that's it, Bill. We're just about all over. We're running out of time.
We're out of time. So from Bill Cable, from Ian Purdy, Phil York, and Ray Lenton, who's joined us today, it's goodbye for now, and we'll look forward to seeing you or hearing and talking to you.
Well, next hearing from us, perhaps.
Maybe that's what it is. Next week on Dad's on the Air.
We ask all the questions that others don't.